So have you ever noticed that men and women, including male and female lawyers, sometimes communicate differently? I started to notice this myself when I was a law student, actually. Here was what I observed. So I was at Columbia in the mid-1990s. So that's an aggressive school, aggressive city, aggressive kind of time. And what I noticed was that when my professors asked questions, 100 male hands would shoot up into the air. The women were much less likely to volunteer unless they absolutely knew that the answer that they were going to give was right. And it seemed to me that a lot of my male classmates did not have that same compunction. They were happy to speak up, even if they had no idea what they were talking about. But here's the thing, after 3 years of doing that, some of them got really good at it. And that's because they didn't care what people thought, they were practicing. They'd answer the questions, and after you do it again and again and again, you can acquire some skill in this area. So I was one of the ones who didn't really want to volunteer. My female classmates and I, who were like this, we were cheating ourselves out of an important part of our legal education, which is the rhetorical component. So I thought maybe that was just law school, but then I went into practice and I noticed the same thing in practice too. In fact, I go back to law firms periodically and I teach classes for folks who are practicing law. And just recently, just this summer, I was at a law firm and a bunch of the women associates were talking about how you go to meetings and the men are so much more likely to take up the airwaves and take up space at the table. They're going to be talking more frequently than the women, and these women were expressing frustration about that. So that's one difference that I have noticed for a long time now, that there are circumstances in which women are less likely to speak up, less likely to volunteer. There's another difference that I noticed. It made some sense that my female classmates and I didn't want to speak up, and that was because if you got something wrong in your answers, maybe you missed the mark because you offered a personal anecdote rather than facts, which was very much frowned upon in that era in law school, or you did something like your tone was a little bit wrong. It seemed to me that the backlash was much more pronounced when it was a woman speaking, that you'd get a lot more eye-rolling, more than your fair share of whispers. There was one classmate that I had who actually got a note left in her folder. That was how we communicated back then, really before email. The note told her to quit talking so much in class, this anonymous note. Can you imagine how devastating that must have been for her? And that struck me as in part about her gender, that there were other people that were equally loquacious, but they were not getting the anonymous note. So that's another difference. You can end up saying something that is exactly what a guy might say, but you might be judged by a different metric. And I would love to believe that that is not true anymore, but I don't believe that it's not true. I think it still continues to happen, that there are going to be situations in which women are going to speak up and the measure is going to be different. So, third thing that I noticed. The women who were able to do this, who got a thick skin, picked themselves up, and tried it again, they became superstars. They could make a splash, and that's definitely true once you graduate from law school and you're out in practice. If you are a woman who can articulate her ideas aloud, you can become the star of the office. It is such an empowering skill. It is a skill that is critical to being a good lawyer anyway, but it's also one that you will find is personally empowering and can really help you soar in your career. That's because a lot of people just don't want to do it. And so if you are the person who decides, I'm going to figure out how to go about doing this, you can make a splash. So obviously you are the people who know how to do this, because that is why you're here. You want to make a splash. How do you go about doing this well? So what I want to offer you today in my 50 minutes of speaking to you is I'm going to give you hallmarks of distinguished advocacy in a nutshell. I'm going to give you the real highlights of what it is you need to think about anytime you're standing up and addressing an audience. And then I also want to highlight for you here and there the things that are different for women. Now, sometimes those differences can be about what the audience thinks it knows about you because of this obvious attribute of yours, the fact that you are female, and stereotypes they might have because of that, or ideas they might have about you. Sometimes the differences are things that we just do differently, those circumstances in which we might speak up differently or might answer in a slightly different way. So I'll point those out as well. But let's start with the basics, and these hold true across the genders. What is it that you want to think about when you stand up to address an audience? So this answer, this question was first answered over 2,000 years ago in ancient Greece by Aristotle. And you might be thinking, why would I go back to Aristotle, kind of out of date? But no, I would say that this has stood the test of time. This is really the kind of building block for understanding how verbal presentations work. So if you want to be persuasive, this is what Aristotle said. He said there are three things that you have to keep in mind, three big picture ideas. So the first is, to be a persuasive advocate, you need to manifest ethos. So ethos means believability, credibility. Your audience has to feel confident that you know what you're talking about and that it can trust you. So there are two things that are important in that concept. First, knowing what you're talking about. That means you're going to have to do your homework. You're going to have to do the reading in order to be able to sound halfway intelligent about a topic. What I have noticed from doing this for years and years now is that your knowledge of a topic, if you're going to talk about it, has to be far deeper, far greater than if you were simply to write about it. You can sort of know about something, know about it well enough for the exam, and be able to write the answer on the exam, and that sort of passing knowledge might get you by. But if you want to stand up and make a verbal presentation about it, you're going to have to know it even better. And that's because in order to explain a concept to somebody else, you're going to have to feel confident about it yourself, and you're going to notice those little leaps in logic, you know, the gaps in your knowledge where you feel like, God, I thought I got this, but now that I'm actually trying to explain it, I realize I don't have it mastered after all. So you want to be credible when you are speaking, and this can be in a formal presentation, like you are making an argument to a jury, or it could be informal, like you're trying to make a presentation to a client. You've got to give yourself some time to really master the information and to try it out loud, to try practicing it, try saying it. Imagine somebody sitting there and you're explaining it to that person, because that is the real test. When you try to explain it and you find yourself hesitating and tripping over something, that's your signal that you need to go find out more about it. Go do the research to fill in your gaps. The other part of ethos is that honesty part, the feeling that this person is a truth teller, that you're not going to cheat, you're not going to sort of bluff your way through or gloss over facts that are bad for you in order to make your point. And that is extremely important. From the second that you encounter somebody in the legal world, any sort of professional interaction that you have, you're starting to establish your reputation. And you're going to find that as a lawyer, it's not just standing up and making an argument to a bunch of jurors that you may never see again. There are many more opportunities for verbal persuasion that will end up being even more important to your career. And those end up being things like, you need to go in and talk to a partner about this memo that you've just written. Or you are the one who is asked to speak to the summer associates about what it's like to be an associate at your firm. Or you're asked to make the presentation to the client explaining what's going on with your case. And in those situations, the people who are listening to you don't just listen to what you're saying right then. They also bring into the conversation everything that they know about you from all other interactions. So your credibility is extremely important. This is one way in which I think we teach you something different from what you maybe want to be doing as a lawyer. In law school, we teach you to bluff. We put you in big classes and we call on you with the Socratic method, and we know that you may not actually know the answer, but we ask you to pretend that you do, and we ask you just to go with it and try to answer, and that's what you should do. That's it's a great practice, because you may find that you do know the answer after all. So if somebody calls on you, bluff and try to answer, because it's a rhetorical training ground for you. But in the real world, when you are a lawyer, you may not want to be bluffing. If a partner asks you a question and you don't know the answer, the better answer might be, I don't know, but I will go find out. Because that is protecting your ethos, your credibility. And that way, when this repeat audience member asks you a question and you say, I do know the answer, that person's going to know she really does know the answer, because she has no problem telling me when she's not sure of what the answer is. So that's ethos, credibility, believability. You got to know what you're talking about, substance to back up your style, and you got to make sure that you are telling the truth. You are being honest. Second Aristotelian concept of persuasion is pathos. So pathos means engaging the emotions. You have to be interesting in some way. And there are two points of connection here. You need to be interested in what you are talking about, and your audience needs to be interested in what you're talking about. Because if you don't care about what you're talking about, and your audience doesn't care about what you're talking about, then it is going to be one very boring presentation. So you got to figure out, what is the heart of this thing? Why do I care about this? Why am I starting here? Why am I making this point? And then you also want to think about, what does my audience need? What do they know? What are their assumptions? Maybe the audience is a client who's very aware of how expensive your time is. So part of what that client needs is, first, understanding of his case, but second, they need you to do it in a pithy way so you're not wasting time and money. So you think about those things, and that's going to help give you an emotional engagement. It's going to be more than just sort of, well, I'm telling you this because that was the homework assignment. If that's what you're doing, it's not going to be very interesting. There are two danger zones in pathos. So one is, you want to make sure that you are not so invested in this topic that you seem to be in the grip of an overwhelming emotion. So you stand up to talk and you find yourself starting to burst into tears, or you're shaking with rage. If there's too much emotion, then the audience is going to think, gosh, this person's judgment is clouded by this overabundance of emotion. And then your ethos takes a hit. You're less credible because you don't seem like you are thinking logically or clearly. The other danger area in pathos is that the audience will feel it if you are trying to tug at their heartstrings unfairly. So if you try to inflame their emotions, you try to get them worked up, the audience will feel that, and they're not going to trust you. They're going to feel like, well, that's kind of cheating. You're going to notice a lot of this stuff in the political campaigns that are coming up. You know, you listen to debates, start thinking about ethos, because maybe they're cheating about facts, not giving you the full story. Start thinking about pathos. Maybe this is somebody who is arguing to the base to try to get them riled up and try to get people, acting out of anger or something. And if that gives you pause, if that makes you feel uneasy, then you'll know, I'm seeing an area where the pathos is out of whack. This person's trying to manipulate me, and so I don't trust it. So that's your second concept of persuasion. You got to be engaging in some way. Third Aristotelian concept of persuasion is logos. So logos is logic, exciting the mind with reason. This is the bread and butter of lawyering. The audience has to hear how you are reaching the conclusion that you are reaching. But here's what you want to think about when you're having to do this aloud. It's a little bit different than if you're doing it simply by writing an essay. In order for your logic to be clear when you are speaking, we need to hear how you're getting from one step to another. So that means the structure has to be extremely clear. We need to be able to hear how one idea ends and then the next one begins. So that could be something as simple as you're pausing as you finish one thought and moving to the next, so we're sort of changing gears with you. Or maybe you have a PowerPoint slideshow like this one, some sort of visual aid that's letting people see what it is you are talking about. You're also going to make choices when you are speaking aloud. So any of you who are doing moot court know this. You can't say every single thing that you know about the case. You just can't. You're going to have to make some decisions. And so what you want to do is pick the most important thing. What is the thing that the judges absolutely have to understand for you to be able to win? That is the heart right there. And that is what you're going to come back to again and again and again. It's what you're going to start with. It's the first sentence that comes out of your mouth. And when you are asked a question, it's what you're going to answer with. You're going to try to link it back as much as you can to your main argument. So that's another important part of logic. You're making choices. You're highlighting the thing that is most significant, and you're not wasting all your time with something that's actually a digression. If you get lost where you're sort of mired in the weeds, then your logic won't be as clear. Another important part of logos is making sure that you're speaking clearly. So that means you use words people can understand. If you were to write a brief for a court, that's going to sound a particular way. When you stand up to talk to the court, it better sound a little bit different. It's got to be easier to process, because what's happening is, even though this is the smartest audience in the world, a bunch of judges, they're having to translate what you say. They're having to be able to understand it right there on the fly without actually being able to read it. And so if you use overly complex words or lots of legal jargon, it's much more difficult to follow your logic. So you want to think about the writing in order to make the logos clear. ethos, pathos, logos. Those are your three big picture goals. If you can do that, if you have achieved those three things anytime you have a verbal interaction, you are doing extremely well. So that's the goal for men and for women.